All right, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union's Sabbath morning study. It's good to be here today. I wanted to take, before I get into today's class, which is, I've got a lot of material to cover, so what I wanted to tell you is if you've not yet signed up for the United Israel Bulletin, if you go to our website, unitedisrael.org, and look to the right, you'll see a sign-up form. It's very easy. You enter in your name and your email address, and that puts you on the mailing list. And one thing that we like to tell people is we don't add anyone's name. You know, all of us in our society today and in our world today, we get too many emails. So we keep that limited. But if you sign up, and that's the only way to get on the list, if you sign up, you'll get our weekly bulletin, which I'm proud to say I think it's getting better each week. So we've got content that's going to be there for you. It sort of recaptures, among other things, everything that James and Ralph and I primarily have written over the past week. But there'll also be other contributors. You know, one of the things that the original constitutions of United Israel call for is that with this bulletin, which is to be one of the primary vehicles to inform our membership, that people can contribute towards that publication of that bulletin. So I want to encourage people, if you have weddings, if you have births and so forth, and you want those in the bulletin, just send that to me and I'll make sure it gets in there. But it is getting better. The quality of it, I think, is getting better, and the content certainly is. So help me help you. That's what it really comes down to. I want to make this bulletin something that people look forward to receiving. The goal is to publish it every Friday, right, as Shabbat comes in, so that people, A, have a direct link to the weekly teaching. So there'll be several things that have come out in there, but that's one of the things. And then, like I said, other articles of interest. And the United Israel Bulletin, as many of you know, has been a publication since 1944. So I'm very pleased to say that it's up and running in earnest, and hopefully you'll sign up for that. Second announcement, and final announcement, I think, is that the final weekend of April, April 28th through 30th, we've got our annual conference here in St. Francisville. We'll be doing that here at the United Israel Center. We've got enough chairs, and we think that it's going to be a lot better environment. We've got some new sound equipment. We've got everything in place. We have special music planned and quite a few, I think, good speakers coming. So be on the lookout, because we're going to publish more in the next week or so. I want to put a bio of each of the speakers out in the next edition of the bulletin so people can begin to get ready for that and so forth. So I want to encourage you to sign up if you've not yet done that. It's on our website. Go to News and Events at the top, unitedisrael.org. Go to News and Events, and you'll see Annual Conference. If you click on that button or that link, it's going to bring you to a page that has the program. It also has all the details about where you can stay when you're in town and so forth. So, now, without further ado, Shabbat Shalom again. We are in the cycle of the triennial portions, but we're going to take a break this week. So if you were so excited to get into Genesis chapter 20, hold that enthusiasm, because that will resume next week. So all of you who studied to get ahead of me, I'm sorry to say you're either going to have to remember what you came up with or look at it again over the next week. I'll resume that next Saturday. Today, I'm going to take a break from our regular cycle of readings according to the triennial cycle. And I want to do that for a very important reason. This was actually the practice in antiquity. I've done a lot of study on these ancient Torah cycles and how the Torah became an integral part of Judaism, the liturgy every Shabbat. But one of the things that has been done since antiquity is that whenever you got to the festival seasons, whenever you entered into a festival, you would break from the normal reading unless that normal reading specifically spoke of that particular festival. So what festival are we in the midst of? We're in the season of Passover. So one of the things that I wanted to do was talk to you today about something that's relevant, I think in more ways than one, to the Passover season. And so what we're going to do is we're going to pick up with what Jews around the world are talking about, at least in terms of the prophetic reading that is assigned to this day. And you might ask, what day is it? Today happens to be the intermediate Sabbath for the Passover. And what that means is, as you know, the season of Passover and unleavened bread is 8 days long. Excuse me. And so that Sabbath that falls in the middle, there is a particular reading that is to be read on that day, and I think you'll understand the relevance and why I'm doing what I'm doing shortly. So as I'll make plain in this teaching, I find it more than interesting to note that given the focus of the Christian world on the resurrection of the Son of God, because as you know, tomorrow around the world, you know, there are approximately 2.2 billion Christians in the world. I would imagine that on Sunday this week, most of them will in some way be talking about the resurrection of God's Son. So what I find interesting, and what does that have to do with what I'm going to talk about today? Well, in synagogues around the world, a special reading will be read on this weekend. A reading that, as I will demonstrate, also speaks of resurrection. Now, this is not just put in place today to make my class work out pretty cool, since every church in the world tomorrow is going to be talking about resurrection. But this is the reading for that intermediate Sabbath of Passover. Now, as you know, when the Christian world celebrates Easter Sunday, it doesn't always coincide with Passover. But separate from what Christians are doing, any intermediate Sabbath of Passover, the discussion includes the text that I'm going to highlight in today's teaching. So as I said, that particular text that is assigned to the intermediate Sabbath speaks of resurrection, but not in a general or generic sense. In other words, I could talk about resurrection. I could give a class on resurrection of the dead as opposed to immortality of the soul, which I am wont to do at times. But rather, this reading is quite specific. I'm talking about the Hebrew Bible. I'm not talking about any other text. There is a special reading that's read in synagogues around the world from the Tanakh, from the Hebrew Bible, that speaks of, as I will show in today's class, the resurrection of God's Son. Now, hopefully I have you hooked with that. I don't know if I do, but hopefully I do. So I want to start today. This is the Pentateuch and Haftarahs, edited by the late Rabbi J.H. Hertz. And many of you have this. I love this commentary. It only contains the Torah portions and the associated prophet readings, but it also contains special readings for the festival days. So I want to open up and read you a portion of the introduction by Rabbi Hertz with this reading today, just to sort of set the tone for today's teaching. So I'm picking up. I'm not giving away my text yet, and some of you might know it, but don't blab it yet. If you can, if you haven't already, don't tell everyone yet. Let me do that. If they did it, if someone did that, just ignore them. So I'm only reading part of this, but it says the following. Both the fact that Passover, recalling past deliverances, looks forward to future redemption and an old tradition that the resurrection of the dead will take place during this festival determine the choice of this passage as today's Haftarah, or prophetic portion. In other words, there is this old tradition that says that the resurrection of the dead, much anticipated in the eschatological scenarios laid forth in the Hebrew Bible, because associated with this particular festival, the festival of Pesach, Passover, there is this tradition that resurrection of the dead will take place here. Now, where would such an idea come from? We will get to the subject at hand, but we want to note that because this is the case, in many ways, and at least according to my view, all of Israel will have a similar subject talked about this week, about the resurrection of God's Son. Now, I understand that the resurrection of God's Son is going to be interpreted differently in church and synagogue. I get that. In fact, some would say, I don't even like for a Torah teacher to speak of such things because those others are keeping it wrongly. In other words, many, many churches and religious institutions that are some way Christian are beginning more and more to keep Passover. But then some would argue, rightly in many ways, that those are not keeping it properly, that it is a non-kosher version, if you will. So I want to begin today by touching on a few points about Passover specifically, because that's the season we're in. Now, if you want to watch our Passover celebration that we did on Monday night, that is archived on our YouTube channel, which I assume you are on if you're watching me this morning. So you can always go watch that later. I won't go into all the details, but I just want to cover a few of the main teaching points associated with Passover. The word Passover in English is translated from the Hebrew Pesach. Pesach. It's comprised of three Hebrew letters, the Pe, the Samech, and the Chet. And most people translate it directly, Passover equals Pesach. And I'll give you an example why. If you go to the Bible's book of Exodus, in Exodus chapter 12, we'll just hit a few verses. Chapter 12, verse 13, it says, "The blood shall be a sign for you upon the houses where you are. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. And no plague shall fall upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt." Then if you go to verse 23, "For Jehovah will pass through." See the pass through, there's our word. Verse 23, "The Lord Jehovah will pass through to slay the Egyptians. When he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, Jehovah will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to slay you." And then we'll go to verse 27. So you see, the text almost gives you the translation and the reasoning behind the translation. Verse 27 of Exodus 12, "You shall say it is the sacrifice of Jehovah's Passover, because he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt when he slew the Egyptians, but spared our houses." Now, there is another view seeking to get at the root meaning of this word in its ancient setting. In 1897, in the Journal of Biblical Literature, a scholar, Toy, gave another view. Now, this is an academic journal. It's a critical piece. And he determined that Pesach, at the root, means to skip or to dance. And the idea that he put forth in this article, I think you can probably find it online, even if you're not a member of Journal of Biblical Literature, from 1897. He says that the idea is that the lambs are skipping and dancing in the spring. And so that's the idea. But be that as it may, Pesach, we are in Pesach season. Now, most of us know the basic story flow. We know this primarily, hopefully, because we're all great students of the Bible. But even those who've not studied these texts extensively might be familiar, at least with the basic storyline from our movies, whether it's Cecil B. DeMille and the Ten Commandments, or if you prefer the cartoon version, The Prince of Egypt. Either way, you get the basic storyline of the text. It's a story of salvation, redemption, deliverance, where the ultimate scenario is that Jehovah repeatedly strikes Egypt with severe blows. And one thing that begins to come out in the text is there are reasons for this, and primarily the reason that tends to show up in each and every episode, blow after blow, is that Pharaoh will know Jehovah, and the people will know Jehovah. You see, ultimately, the goal of the Hebrew Bible that's put forth by the prophets and the writers of the text is that all, you remember Jeremiah 31, the New Covenant, ultimately, all will know Him from the least to the greatest. From the rising of the sun to its setting, they'll know that Jehovah is God. And ultimately, one of the goals that comes out is this idea that the knowledge of God will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. So this idea of knowing, you'll recall that when Moses first goes to Pharaoh and says, "Let us go so that we might go serve Jehovah, our God." And what does he say? "I don't know your God." Now, by the end of the story, things have changed. It's a different world for Pharaoh. Now, this event, this salvific event, is called great, this great thing by Moses in Deuteronomy 6. He says in Deuteronomy 6, beginning in verse 20, you can read this on your own, "Search now from the ancient times, from the time that God made man. Ask," you know, I'm paraphrasing, "there's never been an event like this. God spoke to us through the fire. He had taken a nation from another nation with signs and great wonders. But this is the very thing for which Jehovah became known." I want to read a few passages of Scripture. I'm going to begin in 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 23. And it says, "What other nation on earth is like your people Israel, whom God went to redeem to be His people," listen, "making Himself a name and doing for them great and terrible things by driving out before His people a nation and its God." Now, Isaiah chapter 63. I just want to establish the fact by several witnesses that this is the key. It was to make a name for Jehovah. Isaiah 63 verse 12 says, "Who caused His glorious arm to go at the right hand of Moshe, who divided the waters before them to make for Himself an everlasting name." Jeremiah chapter 32. Jeremiah 32 and verse 20. By the way, I've marked these all carefully in my new Bible. Jeremiah 32 verse 20, it says, "Who has shown signs and wonders in the land of Egypt and to this day in Israel and among all mankind, and has made thee a name as it is this day." You see the global significance of the event? To make a name not only among the children of Israel, but among all the nations. I mean, everyone knows this story. And go with me to Daniel. Daniel chapter 9, verse 15. It says, let's see, I may have the wrong verse here. No, I don't. I'm just in the wrong chapter. Daniel 9, 15. And now, O Jehovah our God, who did bring your people out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand and hast made thee a name as it is this day, we've sinned, we've done wickedly. Now, one more. In the book of Nehemiah. So you'll have these passages. I love to check a theme or a passage like this and look for all the occurrences. In Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 10. Let's start in verse 9. And you did see the affliction of our fathers in Egypt and hear their cry at the Red Sea, and didst perform signs and wonders against Pharaoh and all his servants and all the people of his land. For you knew that they acted insolently against our fathers, and you did get thee a name as it is to this day. Now, such a great deliverance as this, and it's so important in the biblical text that time and again, the deliverance from Egypt is associated with the name of the God of Israel. He becomes the God who saved his people out of Egypt. Became an oath. It became a byword. It became something that would be said that would forever tie the, we thought forever, but I'm going to get to that, to tie the salvation of the people out of Israel to the name of this God. You'll recall that the 10 words, often called the 10 commandments, in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2, and Deuteronomy chapter 5 verse 10, it says, I am Jehovah your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. The very testimony of the living God begins with this association that he is in fact the God who brought the children of Israel up out of Egypt. You have Jehovah, the one who brought the children up out of the land of Egypt. Now, one of the things that we associate this with, this great deliverance, you would think, these are some of my thoughts as I put my class together today. You would think that something that when it happened, it was told, you shall do this perpetually. You shall keep this festival on the 14th day of the first month, right? You would think that something that great that's associated with the very name of God, that it would be kept perpetually without any interruption, but that's not the case. I want to read a couple of passages to you. Beginning in Joshua 5. In Joshua 5, we learn, beginning in verse 10 through 12. Now, first of all, the other thing that's happened in Joshua 5 is we recognize that although the circumcision was required, and one has to be circumcised in order to partake of the Passover. And Joshua 5 tells us that they had not circumcised anyone during the 40 wilderness years. Interestingly enough, it seems to be the case that they didn't keep the Passover either. Now, if you look at verse 10, while the people of Israel were encamped in Gilgal, they did keep the Passover on the 14th day of the month at the evening in the plains of Jericho. And on the morrow after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased on the morrow when they ate of the produce of the field, and the people of Israel had manna no more, but ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Now, something even more specific, because some might argue, well, it doesn't technically say that. You've deduced that based on the text. Then how about this? What if I told you that from the time of the judges, from the time of the judges until the 18th year of King Josiah, the Passover was not kept? And what if I proved it to you? If you look at 2 Kings, let's do that. 2 Kings chapter 23. And I want to begin in verse 21. 2 Kings 23. And the king commanded all the people. Chad, if you would, keep an eye, monitor that chat and make sure that we're okay, audio and video from time to time. And the king commanded all the people, keep the Passover to Jehovah your God as it is written in the book of the covenant. For no such Passover had been kept since the days of the judges who judged Israel, or during all the days of the kings of Israel, or of the kings of Judah. I want you to pay very close attention. Neither the kingdom of Israel nor the kingdom of Judah had kept the Passover. We have a tendency to say that that northern kingdom was bad, 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 and the southern kingdom has been holy, holy, holy the whole time. That is not the case. In fact, Jeremiah says that Judah sinned more grievously than even the northern kingdom, if you can imagine. Verse 23, but in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was kept to Jehovah in Jerusalem. So I want to really get you to understand this. From the time of the judges up until the 18th year of King Josiah, none of the Israelites had kept the Passover. Now that, to me, is very interesting for a lot of reasons. Now, the reason that it's so interesting is because Jehovah's name is associated with this great deliverance. The greatest deliverance. And they don't even keep it. Now, what was it about Josiah? Just quickly while we're here, if you look at verse 25 of 2 Kings 23. Before him, there was no king like him who turned to Jehovah with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. Now, Josiah happens to be one of the heroes of the Bible, perhaps not recognized as he should be, but if you notice, he is the only person in the Bible, the only king who is associated with what Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5 says about how we should be devoted to God. With all of our heart, with all of our soul, and with all of our every is the literal translation. That's what Josiah is. Josiah put everything he had into serving God. Now, I want to quickly move into preparing to lay out what I want to share with you today. That was just sort of a foundational piece. So we've already established that Passover is so significant that God's associated with it by name. We've even associated that the very testimony of God includes a reference to this God as the one who saved Israel out of the land of Egypt. It's the greatest thing. Ask now, from the beginning of time when God created man, we've shown that despite its significance, despite its importance, that no kingdom, the northern nor the southern, kept this from the time of the judges until the 18th year of Josiah. And then in 2 Chronicles chapter 30, in 2 Chronicles chapter 30, we have an interesting story. 2 Chronicles 30 is a story about another great reformer in the Bible, another good king. In fact, 2 Chronicles chapter 29, verses 1 and 2 tell us that Hezekiah did what was right in God's eyes. So when we meet this story in 2 Chronicles 30. Hezekiah has a plan. He wants to keep the Passover. But he's not keeping the Passover as many of us are familiar with it. He is going to keep what's called Pesach Sheni, the second Passover. And many of you know this, but those who do not, in the book of Numbers, in Bamidbar, in Numbers chapter 9, it details, it authorizes, if you will, a second Passover for those who are not right when the first Passover comes. In other words, if you're unclean, if you're defiled, and you can't participate in the Pesach in the first month on the 14th day, there is an allowance made in Numbers chapter 9 to keep it on the second month on the 14th day. Now, the reason that we learn that Hezekiah is going to put this second Passover in effect is for three main reasons. The first of which is that the priests are not sanctified. The priests are not sanctified. And that is found in 2 Chronicles 30, verse 3. For they could not keep it in its time because the priests had not sanctified themselves in sufficient number. All right? And then it says, nor had the people assembled in Jerusalem. Now, why is that a problem? If you know, in Exodus chapter 23, I would go there, but I'll just let you think through these, write these notes down and look at them. Exodus chapter 23, verse 14 through 17. Exodus chapter 34, verse 23. And Deuteronomy chapter 16, verses 16 and 17. It says that in three times in the year, people are to assemble in Jerusalem and keep these feasts. This being one of those pilgrim festivals, as they are often referred to. So the priests haven't sanctified themselves, and the people haven't assembled in Jerusalem, so they missed it. You can't keep the first Passover, so they've got to keep the second. Now, if you look at verse 5, so they decreed to make a proclamation throughout all Israel. All Israel is significant here. Because if you hold your finger there and look back up to verse 1, Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah. And he wrote letters also to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the house of Jehovah at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to Jehovah, the God of Israel. Right? So he's got a plan, and it's significant for my class today. He's calling out to all the tribes of Israel, both Judah and Israel, the northern and southern kingdom, to tell them it's time to get started. It's time for a revival, and we're going to do this through the agency of keeping the feast of Pesach. So verse 5, so they decreed to make a proclamation throughout all Israel from Beersheba to Dan. And if you tour Israel with Tabor and I, you'll do that. That the people should come and keep the Passover to Jehovah, the God of Israel, at Jerusalem. Get this. For they had not kept it in great numbers as prescribed. So, again, the significance of it and their negligence to keep it should astound the reader. I mean, you have to wonder, why would they be so negligent in the most key aspect of the faith? So again, it's to all Israel, the call is to all Israel. Beginning, look at verse 6. This is what he says. You ready? So couriers went, throughout all Israel and Judah. All Israel and Judah, with letters from the king and his princes, as the king had commanded, saying, O people of Israel, return to Jehovah, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may turn again to the remnant of you who have escaped from the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not be like your fathers and your brethren who were faithless to Jehovah, God of their fathers, so that he made them a desolation as you see. Do not now be stiff-necked as your fathers were, but yield yourselves to Jehovah and come to his sanctuary, which he has sanctified forever, and serve Jehovah your God, that his fierce anger may turn away from you. For if you return to Jehovah, your brethren and your children will find compassion with their captors and return to this land. For Jehovah your God is gracious and merciful and will not turn away his face from you if you return to him. Listen to me, ladies and gentlemen, this is key. This letter needs to go out again. This letter needs to go not just to those who consider themselves the lost sheep of the house of Israel, this returning group who have beat themselves up for years saying, we're not worthy, the other house is worthy. This needs to go to both. Now, here's the key message. Return to him, and he'll return to you. Return to him, not another. Zechariah begins. Malachi has this same passage. Return to me, and I'll return unto you. It's contingent. His return is contingent upon our return. Now, here's something that I think is interesting. Hezekiah is the one who matches this three-pronged dedication with all heart, with all soul, and with all his every. And he wrote this letter. I think Hezekiah was onto something. I think it's interesting that Hezekiah uses the time allotted in Numbers chapter 9 for his reform. So we did a Passover on the 14th day of the first month. He's very smart in the way that he does this. By using this time that is allocated for those who were not right, he does the thing that should be done. And so because of that, I want you to know that my intention is to do the same thing, to do a second Passover, so you have to stay tuned for that. Now, here's something that's interesting. Remember when I started and I talked about how there are so many people, primarily from Christianity, many of whom believe that they are the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and I can tell you now, I tend to agree that many of them are. Let that sink in for a minute. And there are many who would look at that group who are trying to keep the Passover and they're not doing it right, and they've added all sorts of elements in to make certain things fit that quite honestly just don't fit, let's be honest. So instead of thinking like Hezekiah does, which I'm going to show you in just a moment, we want to be critical, and I've done it too, we want to be critical of that group, but I want you to think about it. Around the world, by untold thousands, people who didn't grow up in this traditional Judaism are keeping Passover. A lot of people are pointing fingers saying they're doing it wrong, they're not following it the right way. Now, Hezekiah, listen to this. I love this guy. because some of them were eating this, and they did this, and they didn't do it the right way. Let's see, let me find that verse. Okay, look at verse 17. A Passover is going here. It says, for there were many in the assembly who had not sanctified themselves. Therefore, the Levites had to kill the Passover lamb for everyone who was not clean to make it holy to Jehovah. Now, for a multitude of the people, many of them from Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar, and Zebulun had not cleansed themselves. They're not right. They're doing this the wrong way. Listen, yet they ate the Passover otherwise than as prescribed. Listen to me. These people from the tribes, from the northern kingdom, were participating in Passover and they weren't doing it right. You get that? For Hezekiah had prayed for them, saying, "The good Jehovah, pardon everyone." Now, he could have said, "Oh, you're not doing it right. Come down to the southern kingdom and we'll show you how to keep Passover because we've maintained the covenant." No, they did not. They were doing it wrong too. Who sets his heart to seek God, Jehovah, the God of his fathers, even though not according to the sanctuary's rules of cleanness? Now, that's just a prayer. I mean, it's just good wishes by the good king. I mean, he's laid out a case to God that they're not doing it right. They're not clean. They're keeping the Passover. Let's see verse 20. "And Jehovah heard Hezekiah and healed the people." I could shut the book right now. And I could say that in all our judgmental, in all of our accusations, in all of our finger pointing, in all of our making fun, I could go on and on and on. Hezekiah knew that they weren't doing it right. He knew several things. He knew that it was essential that the people make a revival. He knew that spring and Passover and this great thing was something that would somehow rally the tribes, both northern and southern. He knew it was an opportunity to tell them that you've all failed in this. But he saw it as the greatest opportunity to pray for the people of Israel that Jehovah might heal them, and Jehovah did, because he's gracious and long-suffering and Rav Chesed, much, much loving kindness. Now, we find ourselves in a similar place today. Many, many, many are awakening the Torah faith and to the possibility, remote as it might be in the mind of some, that they could very well be Israel. They don't have proof. They don't have the pedigree that they know of. They didn't grow up wearing tzitzit and kippah. They didn't grow up keeping Passover or any of the festivals. Let me tell you something about this group. They sought God with all their heart. They either walked away or are walking away from the traditions that bound them. They are personally, individually, and collectively being delivered from the captivity that has enslaved them, because the shepherds have led them astray long enough. And these people have cried out to God. And every time God's people cry, that's when he moves on their behalf. YHWH has long stood beside those who among the nations had an inner feeling. Now, some scoff at this and say, you can't base anything upon your feeling. Well, let me tell you something about that feeling. That feeling is driving people to forsake unclean foods. It's driving them to begin to walk and act and keep things according to the Torah. These people, by the millions, I would challenge you to consider, are waking up in all nations, red and yellow, black and white. You can't look at these people and say, that is one of the lost tribes. It's going to be a matter of the heart. Many aren't prepared. Many don't know what to do. Many of them will be looking for books this year on how do I do this? How do I keep Shabbat? What's a sukkah, if they can pronounce it right? They'll be wearing their tzitzit on their belt loops. Some of them think that in order to be right with God, they've got to convert. I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying the masses are seeking Yehovah, and they don't know where to go. Jeremiah chapter 50, verses 4 through 7 describes this scene. It says that they'll come weeping, the children of Israel and the children of Judah, asking the way to Zion, their faces turned toward it. Think about that. I love this image. They're saying, could you, sir, tell me where Zion is? And the answer is, you're walking that way. Just keep walking. Look, don't criticize people. Help them. You say, look, I tell you what, I've not been there myself, but I'm headed that way. Walk with me. Let's walk together. See, that's what Hezekiah did. And yet, even for all of the baggage that Israel has as it wakes up, all of the false teachings, I've seen people break down in tears when they realize that they've been wrong. I've seen people crying over the mistakes that they've made in their religious journey because of the sincerity of their heart to get it right. And so I think we ought to be praying that Yehovah will pardon all of us, and I mean all, as we seek to do according to His will. So I think it's important that we begin to think about hosting a second Passover. And as I often point out, I want the focus to be on an even greater Exodus, spoken of by Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 16, Jeremiah mentions it twice. We're going to read both of them. Because this second Passover, I told you, I made a point to stress how important it was that Passover be associated with the name of the living God. But I want you to look at Jeremiah 16, verse 14. Jeremiah 16, 14 says, therefore, behold, days are coming, says Yehovah, when it shall no longer be said, as Yehovah lives who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. Did you get that? There is coming a time when this will no longer be said. But, verse 15, as Yehovah lives who brought up the people of Israel out of all the north country and out of all the countries where He had driven them, for I will bring them back to their own land, which I gave to their fathers. Now, listen to me closely. This Torah-oriented group that's waking up all over the world, our mantra becomes Torah, Torah, Torah. I'm Torah observant. I'm in a Torah study group. I'm Torah. I'm this. I'm that. Look, do you know that the Torah's got to change? When people talk about the new covenant, the answer of this awakening Torah group is, we always say, no, it's not going to change. God's going to take His Torah, Genesis 1:1 through Deuteronomy chapter 34:12, and He's going to write it in little bitty letters all over your heart. And that's what the Torah in the heart is. It's not the same Torah, people. It says it's not like the covenant that I made with their fathers when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke, though I was their husband. It's different. Now, how's it different? Well, I'll give you one example right here. No longer will it be said, the Lord lives who brought the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt. Well, listen to me closely. Do you realize that that means that the Ten Commandments have to change? You think I'm kidding. Listen, how does the 10 words testimony begin? I am Yehovah your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Sheep. It's not going to be in there. Now, is it going to say, I am Yehovah your God who brought you out of all the lands into which I had driven them? you shall have no other... I don't know. But I do know that at least according to Jeremiah, and he is my favorite prophet, things are going to change. In the former Exodus, Israel was delivered from the oppression of Egypt. In the latter Exodus, Israel will be delivered from all the lands into which the children of Israel have been scattered. Look, this movie, the next Cecil B. DeMille, is going to have a harder job because it's going to look a lot different. I don't know if all the oceans are going to split. I don't know if Isaiah 60, when he says, who are these who fly on the clouds like doves? I don't know if it's El Al flights. I don't know. But I can tell you it's going to be remarkable. But it's a gathering of which all the prophets spoke often about. It's the key theme of all the prophets. The major dominant theme in the prophets, and as I point out often, Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 37 through 41, this is the one thing that God will do with all His heart and all His soul. What? Bring Israel from wherever they're at and plant them in His land in faithfulness. You might ask, where is our shepherd? Where is our Moses? Who is it who will lead these people? In Micah chapter 6, it refers, it seems, to someone who will take that role. It could be, as in the days of the former Exodus, where you had Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. But here's where I... Now look, I'm excited today because I feel a liberty to tell it like it is, like I've never felt before. Listen to me. Everyone who is thinking that this particular group is who has it all figured out and I'm going to run over there and they've kept it faithfully, no one has kept it faithfully. Jeremiah 23. Woe to the shepherds who destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture, says Jehovah. Therefore, thus says Jehovah, the God of Israel, concerning the shepherds who care for my people. You've scattered my flock and have driven them away, and you've not attended to them. Behold, I will attend to you for your evil doing, says Jehovah. Then I will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries where I've driven them, and I will bring them back to their fold, and they will be fruitful and multiply. I will set shepherds over them who will care for them, and they shall fear no more, nor be dismayed, neither shall any be missing, says Jehovah. Behold, days are coming, says Jehovah, when I'll raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely. And this is the name by which he will be called, Jehovah is our righteousness. Therefore, behold, days are coming, listen, says Jehovah, when men shall no longer say, as Jehovah lives who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as Jehovah lives, who brought up and led the descendants of the house of Israel out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them, then they shall dwell in their own land. This is as sure as the sunrise. But I want you to notice, it begins with a condemnation of the shepherds. I told you that the dominant theme in Scripture is about the tribes and going back to the land. Let me tell you, I just recently completed a study of the prophets where I went through carefully and read and marked and studied. I would argue that the more dominant theme, if, you know, I keep saying that the tribes are the most dominant, but it's a close association because it's often connected with this. It's that the shepherds are the problem. The leaders, the religious leaders. I told Chad yesterday, it's like, have you ever watched a thriller, a drama? on TV and you know, you've been watching the film and you know that the cops are bad. Just as an example, stick with me. And you call the police in the movie, the person who's in trouble calls the police and the bad guy shows up. It's as dramatic when I tell you that the religious leaders that people have been flocking to, they're bad. They're the problem. Ezekiel 34 puts it more strongly than I just did reading Jeremiah 23. You want to read about what God thinks about the shepherds of His people? Ezekiel 34 is a railing accusation. They've taken care of themselves. Look, they've used the flock. Oh, they fleece them. They get the wool. They use the they eat the meat. They do it, but they don't take care of the flock. They don't do the work of a shepherd. So read Ezekiel 34. What happens in Ezekiel 34, because the shepherds haven't fed the flock, God says, I will feed them myself. And He does. And that, I believe, is why so many people are waking up today, because they are growing weary of being bored to tears in churches and probably synagogues too, of hearing a watered-down message, and they begin to pray and call out to God. And you know what they really do? Look at this. They begin to read this, and God begins to speak to them. God said, I'll feed my own sheep. Thank you very much. See, Moses had, he didn't want the people to be without a shepherd. You know, it's interesting. Even after God told him, you're not going into the promised land because you failed to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel. You know, he speaks to God again, even after God said, that's it. Don't ask me again to go in the land. You know what the final words that God, that Moses speaks to God that we have recorded in the Bible? The last recorded words. Now, it's not in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is recapping things. But here's the last thing Moses says to God. It's in Numbers chapter 27. Numbers chapter 27, verse 15. Moses said to Jehovah, let Jehovah, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of Jehovah may not be as sheep which have no shepherd. It's the last thing he requests. Because you know the image of sheep without a shepherd is a bad image. There are enemies out there. There are wolves, there are bears. And no telling what else. And then there are what some might call hirelings. And people who put themselves over the flock, who don't care for the sheep, who teach them traditions of men and things that aren't scriptural in place of feeding them real food. You can't sustain life with what's being fed to these sheep. You know, I've heard that sheep, and I'm not a shepherd, I'm not an expert at this, but I've heard that sheep, if you don't move them to good grass, they will literally eat all the grass and lick the dirt. Now, I don't know if that's true about sheep, but I know it's true about people because I'm watching a lot of people eat dirt right now. Someone needs to say, look, come over here and eat. Go to Zechariah chapter 10 with me. Zechariah chapter 10. All right. Let me just read verse 2 first. For teraphim utter nonsense, and the diviners see lies. The dreamers tell false dreams and give empty consolation. Therefore, the people wonder. W-A-N-D-E-R, wander, like sheep, they are afflicted for want of a shepherd. Listen to me. The idolatry, the false dreams, these empty dreamers, it's nothing. And this is what these sheep are getting. So guess what? The people wander like sheep because there is no shepherd. All right, now there's a white space in the Hebrew. And then I want to begin in verse 3. So here, the first verse sort of sets it. It says, look, what I'm fixing to do with this white space is show you a break. It says people have no shepherd. Now, white space, now here's what follows. It's a connecting thought, but it's separated for emphasis. Verse 3, my anger is hot against the shepherds, and I will punish the leaders. For Jehovah of hosts cares for his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them like his proud steed in battle. Out of them shall come the cornerstone, out of them the tent peg, out of them the battle bow, out of them every ruler. Together they shall be like mighty men in battle, trampling the foe in the mud of the streets. They shall fight because Jehovah is with them, and they shall confound the riders on horses. I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph. Notice both. I will bring them back because I have compassion on them, and they shall be as though I had not rejected them. For I am Jehovah their God, and I will answer them. Then Ephraim shall become like a mighty warrior, and their hearts shall be glad as with wine. Their children shall see it and rejoice. Their hearts shall exult in Jehovah. I will signal for them and gather them in, for I have redeemed them, and they shall be as many as of old. Though I scattered them among the nations, listen, yet in far countries they shall remember me. And with their children they shall live and return. I will bring them home from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria. I'll bring them to the land of Gilead and to Lebanon until there is no room for them. They shall pass through the sea of Egypt, and the waves of the sea shall be smitten, and all the depths of the Nile dried up. The pride of Assyria shall be laid low, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart. And I will make them strong in Jehovah, and they shall glory in His name, says Jehovah. This begins with anger directed towards the shepherds. In verse 6, we see that Judah is mentioned first. And the former places of the dispersion are mentioned in verses 10 and 11 as if to say the remnants of those who were in Egypt and Assyria. This speaks of the dispersions, and bringing them back, if you will. Isaiah chapter 11, verses 10 and 11. You'll have to read this on your own. But it's also the same thing. He says, I will stretch forth my hand a second time and get that remnant. Judah has to move first, by the way. Why do I know that? Because in Numbers chapter 10, verse 14, whenever the troops begin to move, Judah moves first. So the prophets are very specific. Judah will be saved first. That's the way it works. And indeed, history has obliged. The Jews are back in the land, valiantly defending the land of Israel that was given as an inheritance to all the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But the rest are not there yet. I love verse 9 of chapter 10. Though scattered among the nations, yet in far countries they will remember me. And what this is describing is also spoken of in many other places. Deuteronomy 30 comes to mind. Before the children of Israel had ever taken possession of the land, Moses is standing on the lip looking into the promised land, and he says, when all these things come upon you, the blessings and the curse, they ain't even gone in yet, and he tells them, you're going to get the blessing, you're going to get the curse. He says, when they call it to mind, is the English. The Hebrew says, when they return to the heart. I believe that's what's happening now. Listen, a famine figures prominently in the first Exodus story. Remember, a famine is what put the people in Egypt preparing for the redemption. Well, you know the story. Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers. He ends up exalted into a position where if you want life, you've got to go through Joseph. But I want you to remember, it begins with a famine. And so too will the second Exodus begin. But here's what's going to drive this one. It's not a famine of bread and water. Amos chapter 8, verse 11. Incidentally, Amos is a prophet to the northern kingdom. Amos says that there is a famine, not of bread and water, but of hearing the word of Jehovah. And because there's such a famine for the true word, see, people aren't teaching the word. They're teaching what other people taught about the word, or this great sage, or this great scholar, or this great preacher said. Look, that's not sustaining life anymore. I'm just telling you, what's going to feed the flock is the pure, unadulterated word. Thus saith Jehovah. It was Joseph who provided that food for famine, and I'm telling you, I believe that once again, Joseph will provide food for famine in the second Exodus. So, the prophet reading today, Ezekiel chapter 37. Ezekiel 37, beginning in verse 1. The hand of Jehovah was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of Jehovah and set me down in the midst of the valley. It was full of bones. And he led me round them. Behold, there were very, very many upon the valley, and lo, they were very dry. And he said to me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Adonai Jehovah, you know. And he said to me, prophesy to the bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of Jehovah. Thus says Adonai Jehovah to these bones, Behold, I will cause breath to enter you, and you shall live, and I will lay sinews on you, and will cause flesh to come upon you, and cover you with skin, put spirit in you. Some translations say breath. It's ruach in Hebrew. And you shall live, and you shall know that I am Jehovah. So I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I prophesied, there was a noise, and behold, a rattling. Bones came together, bone to bone, and as I looked, there were sinews on them, and flesh had come upon them. Skin had covered them. But listen, but there was no spirit in them, no breath in them. Now, I just want to make a point. When he prophesied at first, he said, hear the word. When these bones come together, there's no life in them. Now listen, verse 9. Then he said to me, prophesy to the spirit, prophesy, son of man, and say to the breath, thus says Adonai Jehovah, come from the four winds, O spirit, or breath, and breathe upon these slain that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and the breath came into them, and they lived and stood upon their feet, an exceedingly great host. And he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Please hear me when I say whole house. Behold, they say, our bones are dried up, our hope is lost, we are clean cut off. Therefore, prophesy and say to them, thus says Adonai Jehovah, behold, I will open your graves, and I will raise you from your graves, O my people, and I will bring you home into the land of Israel. And you shall know that I am Jehovah when I open your graves and raise you from your graves, O my people. And I'll put my spirit within you, and you shall live, and I will place you in your own land. Then you shall know that I, Jehovah, have spoken, and I have done it, says Jehovah. He prophesies at first, and he says, hear the word of Jehovah. And why does the prophecy begin like that? Because these people are dead. They're dead. The image is meant to create a very obvious picture. It's talking about resurrection. And the first thing that happens is the bones come together in flesh and muscle and it become. But look, that once they're together and they've heard, see, the word of Jehovah brings them together. But they're still lifeless. What has to happen is that Ezekiel, the prophet, then has to speak to the spirit and say, breathe upon these that they might live. Look, the whole house of Israel is seen by Ezekiel as in the grave. It requires a resurrection from the dead. Now, there are some that are assembled, right? But I'm saying there is. This is describing something I would challenge anyone who says that's happened yet. Now, I do think we're coming together. But I think that's going to increase and the rattling is going to get louder and the shaking is going to become more obvious the more that Joseph provides food for famine and the more that you hear people saying, thus saith Jehovah. That's the word of Jehovah. That's what does what? It brings life. Because famine, what's the famine? The famine is you don't have the word of Jehovah. So if the food for the famine is very simple, here's the word of Jehovah. Not the word of men, not the word of teachers, the word of Jehovah. There's a second parable that we're not going to get into in depth, but it describes that there are two sticks. You've seen me do this illustration. I've made a point many, many times. It's not the reading today, but it's another parable by Ezekiel. And you'll notice that Judah is in the land. Read it carefully. And that Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, is scattered and it's going to be brought and put on the other. So that's a major point, something that needs to happen. Judah is in the land. Joseph is not. Now, where have I heard that? Go with me to Jeremiah chapter 31. Jeremiah chapter 31. Jeremiah 31, beginning in verse 15. Thus says Jehovah. This, by the way, is set off by white spaces. A voice is heard in Ramah. Lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are not. Her children, Rachel's children. We're talking about Joseph and Benjamin and those associated with Joseph. It's a prophecy. Rachel weeping for her children, this isn't about the killing of infants. How do I know that? Well, I just keep reading. Listen to verse 16. Thus says Jehovah, keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work shall be rewarded, says Jehovah. They shall come back from the land of the enemy. Who is they? Rachel's children. They're not dead somewhere in a literal sense. They're dead in the sense that they're among the nations. There is hope for your future, verse 17, says Jehovah. And your children shall come back to their own country. No law is going to keep it from happening. No current condition of making aliyah is going to stop it when it's time. It's going to have to change. It's going to have to make way. People are going to have to be able to go back. Why? Because thus saith Jehovah. Listen, verse 18. I've heard Ephraim bemoaning. You've chastened me, and I was chastened like an untrained calf. Bring me back that I may be restored, for you are Jehovah my God. For after I turned away, I repented, and after I was instructed, I smote upon my thigh. I was ashamed, I was confounded, because I bore the disgrace of my youth. Listen, Ephraim is crying. You know why Ephraim is crying? Because Ephraim is ashamed. But Ephraim has received instruction. And as Ephraim learns that they've made mistakes, they smite the thigh. Okay, verse 20. Is Ephraim my dear son? Is he my darling child? This is Jehovah speaking. Jehovah is talking about his son, his darling son, his dear son. Listen, for as often as I speak against him, I do remember him still. Therefore, my heart yearns for him. I will surely have mercy on him, says Jehovah. When Moses was sent to Pharaoh, he was told, when you go to Pharaoh, Jehovah tells him, when you go to Pharaoh, you tell him this, let my son, my firstborn Israel, go, or I'll smite your son. Now, Moses doesn't deliver that message. The message gets delivered, but he doesn't do what he's told to do in Exodus 4. You follow it through the narrative, please do. But he's told very clearly, it's made plain that Jehovah's son is named Israel. He's called Ephraim in Jeremiah 31. And the prophet Hosea, you know, I'm reminded where it ends in Jeremiah 31:20 at the white space. I will surely have mercy on him. You'll recall Hosea, prophet to the northern kingdom, marries a harlot by the name of Gomer. They have three children. The children's name are Jezreel, Lo Ruhamah, and Lo Ami. God will scatter. He will not have mercy. And they'll not be his people. And then it requires a working backwards. Those who have become lo ami, not my people, who were scattered throughout all nations, Amos says, as corn is sifted through a sieve, yet not the least grain will fall to the ground. My eyes are on all their ways. Jehovah knows where every one of his are. And he's beginning to wake them up. And as he wakes those scattered ones up, he will have mercy on them. And where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there it will be said to them, B'nai El Chai, sons of the living God. Sons of God are waking up all over the place. Later, Hosea would say in chapter 11, verse 1, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. This doesn't have anything to do with a later messianic figure. It's talking about a redemption from Egypt for which God became known. And so too will he bring his son from all nations into which he's been scattered. See, Joseph, according to the narrative in Genesis, was thought to be dead. His father thought he was dead. He wept grievously for the death of his son. He says, my son is not. Rachel, in Jeremiah 31, is pictured by the prophet as weeping for her son because he is not. When Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, which is a key prophetic moment in the book of Genesis, when the boys go back and tell their dad, Od Yosef Chai, Joseph is alive. The master of the dreams has become the master of the world because God exalted him. Joseph didn't exalt himself. God exalted Joseph. And the only way that that reunion takes place is when a humbled Judah, approaches Joseph in tears, and their only concern is the father. That's the way the reunion takes place. You will not have an exalted Judah and an exalted Joseph and an arrogant. Look, that envy, Joseph has to stop envying Judah. Now, this is prophet stuff. I'm not making this up. Joseph has got to stop being jealous of Judah, which he's very jealous now, wants to be like him, wants to be him. Judah has got to stop harassing Joseph. That's just what Isaiah said then. Ezekiel speaks about a resurrection of the dead, specifically a resurrection of Israel. He's calling them forth from their graves, which represents the nations of the world. Hosea, though, we have to go to Hosea to get the detail because we want to get specific. When? Go to Hosea chapter 6. Hosea chapter 6. Verse 1, let's just start there. Come, let us return to Jehovah, for he has torn, and he will heal us. He's stricken, he'll bind us up. Listen, after 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he'll raise us up, that we may live before him. See, the goal is to bring Israel up out of the grave, place them in their land in faithfulness as he swore. This will be done on the third day. You can get caught up in the math, but we're talking if prophetically a day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years are 1 day. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in the third day. Israel was scattered. The northern kingdom was taken into captivity in roughly 722 BCE. Do the math. So something incredible is happening. People around the world, north, south, east, west, in faraway countries are remembering Jehovah. And when they do, they're returning not unto teachings of men, but unto the pure, clear word of Jehovah. And they're saying, I want to live my life according to that. No substitute will do. I recently sat down and read through documents, the Pauline epistles, which I grew up with. And after reading the pure Hebrew Bible for many, many years, I can tell you that there is no comparison at all. There's a big difference in saying, Timothy, bring my coat when you come, and thus saith Jehovah. Big difference. What people have been listening to for thousands of years now is a message that doesn't feed. It's food that doesn't sustain. So as it turns out, today, in synagogues around the world, Ezekiel 37, verses 1 through 14 will be read. And they will hear the story of the dry bones. Will it impact them? I don't know. Will they understand that Israel is the Son of God, and that Israel, the whole house of Israel, is being raised from the dead, and therefore, the story that they're hearing today is about the resurrection of the Son of God? Will they understand that Hosea talks about a third day resurrection of Israel from the dead, and that this is the Son of God? Do you know that tomorrow many of the lost sheep of the house of Israel sitting in Baptist, Methodist, Episcopal, Catholic, Pentecostal, Charismatic, whatever, will be hearing a message that speaks in those same terms, the resurrection of the Son of God on the third day, will they understand a deeper message? I do not know. But I do know this. The true shepherd, the shepherd of shepherds, the one who's angry with the false shepherds who've not taken care of his flock, I pray that he speaks to those sheep, that he feeds those sheep as he said he would. Because as he begins to feed them, the other shepherds become superfluous. You don't even need them. They didn't take care of the sheep. They used the sheep. They abused the sheep. They didn't help the sheep. He said, I'll be the shepherd. Thank you very much. I'm doing it. And those people who are crying out, they're going to get fed. And I'm praying not only in this area, but in every town across America and around the world, that these sheep grow tireder and tireder of eating dirt and that the true shepherd bring them to good pasture. I believe that like Joseph of old, Joseph is presently in his personal Egypt today, thought to be dead by his family members, not recognized when they do see him. He looks like an Egyptian. They don't recognize him. They speak Hebrew around him and think he doesn't even know Hebrew. Let me tell you, they got some Egyptian-looking people in the world that can speak Hebrew today. And they're in Baptist churches, and they're in Methodist churches, and they're in Catholic churches, and they're in charismatic churches, because God's calling his people home. And they're learning the holy tongue. And you might be surprised. Some of these people can walk in the midst of a Jewish group, and they know exactly what they're talking about. They carry Hebrew Bibles around with them to the grocery store. They can read it for themselves. And Judah doesn't know that yet. The boys are carrying on in the story. They're talking in Hebrew, and Joseph doesn't need an interpreter. He knows exactly what they're saying. But Joseph is thought to be dead. He'd adapted to his new life, married an Egyptian woman, had children. Genesis 41, verses 50 through 57. I want you to read that on your own because it has to do with the names of Joseph's children. I think it's quite significant. Ephraim and Manasseh. See, he's become fruitful in his new life and he's forgotten some things from the past. And that's what's happened to Israel today. Once again, famine strikes. And I say to you on this weekend, when all of Israel is hearing a message on resurrection, I say to you, hear the word of Jehovah. And I say to the Spirit, breathe on these slain that they might live. And to Jehovah, I humbly request that as Israel begins to come to life, please pardon us as we attempt to live our lives in accordance with the teaching of Scripture. And as we look forward to the greater exodus spoken of by all the prophets. Shabbat Shalom.